Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Do you like Sheffield Live? Why not become a friend of Sheffield Live? Sheffield Live is a community radio station, and Friends of Sheffield Live are people in the community who make a regular donation to keep Sheffield Live on the air. Join the Friends of Sheffield Live by writing to friends@sheffieldlive.org or go online to sheffieldlive.org/friends. Do you want to get your message heard? With low advertising rates and great sponsorship opportunities, Sheffield Live can help you reach thousands of local people. Get your campaign on Sheffield Live. To find out more about advertising on Sheffield Live, write to advertising@sheffieldlive.org or call 0114 281 4082.
Cosa vuoi da me? Che cosa vuoi ancora? Che cosa vuoi di più? Che cosa vuoi da me?
Che cosa vuoi da me?
Che cosa posso dare?
Che cosa posso dare?
Che cosa inventare? Qu'est-ce que tu veux de moi?
Qu'est-ce que tu veux de moi?
Che cosa vuoi di più?
Che cosa vuoi di più?
Qu'est-ce que tu veux de moi?
Qu'est-ce que tu veux de moi?
Che cosa vuoi provare? Che cosa vuoi tentare? Che cosa vuoi spezzare? Qu'est-ce que tu veux de moi? Che cosa vuoi di più? Qu'est-ce que tu veux de moi? Qu'est-ce que tu veux de moi? Che cosa vuoi sognare? Che cosa vuoi tentare?
Che
cosa vuoi ancora?
Che
cosa vuoi capire? Che cosa vuoi tentare?
Che cosa?
Qu'est-ce que tu veux de moi?
Qu'est-ce que tu veux de moi?
Che cosa vuoi di più?
Che cosa vuoi di più?
Qu'est-ce que tu veux de moi?
Todo, todo.
Che cosa vuoi di più?
Che cosa?
Che cosa vuoi di più? Che tu veux de moi?
Porto amor, porto amor.
Todo,
todo lo daría.
Che cosa vuoi di più?
Che cosa?
I'm Sam Hindley.
And I'm James Fagan.
Every Friday morning, it's our great pleasure to present Thank Goodness It's Folk.
Sheffield's one of the fastest growing hubs of folk music in the country. It's a thrilling city to live in. We try and bring that buzz to you every week with the best in new releases, interviews, and live performances from folk musicians passing through Sheffield.
2 hours of the best folk music from the UK and beyond.
So join us on Sheffield Live every Friday from 10 a.m. for Thank Goodness It's Folk.
For 2 hours of the finest new alternative music,
tune into The Breakdown
every Saturday between 3 and 5 p.m.
only on Sheffield Live
93.2.
For the latest from the unsigned music scene, join Luke Crofts and Danny Pietnik for Sunday Sounds, every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM, and online at sheffieldlive.org. Sunday Sounds, every Sunday at 2 p.m.
Sunday night at 9 p.m. it's the Night Train.
A non-stop musical journey taking in music from around the globe.
Funk, soul, rock and roll,
Latin scorchers, scratchy 78s,
deep gospel, Delta blues,
heavyweight dub, psychedelic nuggets, and a whole lot more.
The Night Train, Sundays 9 p.m. here on Sheffield Live.
The Max Chance Show is now on from 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesdays. Hear eclectic music and a bit of comedy.
There's a place I must go. There's a place I must go. It's not a place I...
Drama.
Poetry.
Stories.
Comedy.
This
is Right Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Sheffield Live and this is Right Radio with me, Jane. This is quite an emotional show for me because it is our penultimate Right Radio and my last show. So I'm hoping it's going to be a really good one, which I think it is. It's been a heck of a 6 years and happily, I will have a chance to discuss that a bit later on in the show. But let me tell you what is going to be happening on the show. First of all, we've got the monologue, Drinking to Excess in Order to Express by Karen Mulcahy. And this really is one of our most classic Right Radio stories and certainly one of my favourites. And then we've got our interview with me being interviewed by my producer and talking about my Right Radio journey over 6 years. And then we're going to end off the first hour with Where We're Coming From, Where We're Going To by Jim Jeeps, read by Sam Birch. And then in the second hour, we've got Callum Island Dinging Rentals by Isaac Stovall, read by Dan Sumption. And then we've got another one of my favourites, and only slightly because I'm in it, Head to Face with Stanley Mendicant, written by Daniel Palmer, featuring me, Jane, and my old co-host, Chad. So there you go. That's what's coming up. Let's get on with it. So first of all, we've got Drinking to Excess in Order to Express by Karen Mulcahy.
You were drunk. The only time you talked was when you were drunk. Slumped defeatedly in your armchair, smoking a roll-up, the evening's tinny and glass debris at your feet. A betting slip sticking out of your stained shirt pocket. Tattooed arms, scarred from factory work, rest next to the taped together remote control. You are drunk. The TV flickers. Jimmy Cagney sobs for mercy before the electric chair as a favour to a priest in Angels with Dirty Faces. Drunk, you begin. When I look back, I have no happy memories. Drunk on misery, you go on. He was a hard man. We all hated him. Your diamond blue eyes stare for a long time. Bloodshot round the edges. Drunk. I try not to breathe too loudly for fear that if I disturb you, you'll stop, and I'll never get to know you again like this. But I'm on tenterhooks, and you are drunk. I listen as you describe playing at the house that backed onto yours and hearing your mother scream as he forced himself on her. You recall how your mate ignored it to save you embarrassment. You take another sip and cough. Your family were known in the neighbourhood, a poor neighbourhood, Little Island in Liverpool. I know this already from other sources, but I do not speak. This is your story. Drunk, faltering and stumbling over words that you have never said, you go on. Your family were the lowest of the low, only one step above your next-door neighbours who'd had 3 kids taken off them, even then, when social services didn't seem to exist. Your family was a disgrace. No shoes on your feet growing up by the docks, eating corned beef hash on side plates when the money hadn't been spent on booze, running the daily gauntlet to avoid beatings, the morning regime, run to the corner shop, buy a paper for him and get it back to him or else. Then race to school to be there in time for the bell for the nuns, or else. You became a sprinter. One of the few things you excelled at, apart from boxing and uncontrollable rage. I know this too from other sources, but I do not speak. Your mates always said you were funny until you lost your temper. Then you had to be dragged off the unsuspecting boy whose face you'd pummeled into disfigurement. As if each punch released an atom of tension, each thud of connection a memory of injustice, each crack of bone screamed, "This is for you!" And you would have gone on if not stopped. Six of you shared a single bed and covered up using coats. You stop for a moment. The bedroom causes you discomfort. I wait. Jimmy Cagney is dead and the boys are distraught that he showed such cowardice.
Ricky Sullivan died of...
You drink.
I don't believe it. I don't believe one rotten word of it.
You describe confession age 7. You were so terrified that you had nothing to confess. You made something up. You hated the Catholic Church and all the sin it heaped upon you. It always forgave the wrong people, you said. Another can open, words struggling to escape from the back of your throat. You press on. He had his own seat in the pub, the Orient. And nobody sat there. It was Johnny Mack's seat. Johnny Mack had been a soldier. You described how he only talked about it late at night once, when drunk. You had listened. He carried his injured best mate on his back for 33 miles and discovered he'd been carrying a dead man for most of it only when he stopped. He had one eye slightly larger than the other, which gave him an insane look when he raged. Unlike your gem-like blues, he had deep, penetrating brown eyes that gave nothing away. He had tattoos. He didn't hug or smile. He drank. He cycled unsteadily home from whichever job he could hold on to, coal sacks on each handlebar, slammed the door and picked fights. You move on to both of them. I listen. You describe her singing gypsy songs, harmonised with your own powerful, pure voice. It's the only time I see you smile. It doesn't last. You gulp a mouthful down fast. They'd wake up in their own piss with bruises and cuts all over them, having hit each other with kitchen pans the night before. They'd have no idea what happened. They smoked and they drank. They loved. They were punch drunk. Another can hisses open. You darken. The day a tramp knocked on the door. It was your dar's old army mate. He slept in the bed with all six of you. You awoke to him touching you. You never said anything. I say nothing. You stare again. No sign of a tear. A deep pool of sadness, and I think I make out a pinprick of anger. A flash of fear, pain, confusion. Then sadness again. Breathtaking, crushing sadness. The priest comforts the boys whose hero wept for mercy, imploring them to change their ways.
What happened? Did Rocky die like they said?
You drain. You look weary. I sit completely still listening. I can sense an ending. Your hands shake. It's late and you shift in your seat. You say, "When I turned up there," she answered the door with blood on her dress. She was dying and he hadn't noticed she was bleeding down below. I took her in the car to the hospital. She was in agony. I wanted to kill him then. Just before she died, she called out, "John!" A nurse ran for me to let me know she was asking for me. I'd been there every day. I held her hand and she said, "Johnny Mack, I love you." She thought I was him. She died. Outside in the corridor, he hugged me for the first time. I thought, "Well, sod you, it's too late," and walked away. You are drunk. You are sad. "Dads aren't all they're cracked up to be, kid," you say. The credits roll. Abruptly, you get up and go to bed. I sit for a moment. I clear up the debris. I decide to get drunk.
It's true, boys. Every word of it.
That was Drinking to Excess in Order to Express by Karen Mulcahy. And this really is such a Right Radio classic. And what me and Chad always found when we were in the studio is that if this story was on, we really found it very difficult to get on with anything else because it's just such a hard hitter. And now we've got an interview with a very interesting person. That is me being interviewed by the producer about what a wonderful time I've had being a Right Radio host.
So, Jane, the tables are about to turn.
It's exciting.
I've long been the producer, hiding myself away, editing myself out of all my interjections at the conversation as far as I can, if I occasionally have a point to raise while you interview, I mean, all manner of people over the last 6 years.
I like having you there, like a sort of security blanket.
Yeah, like a cuddly Jiminy Cricket or something.
Yeah, just going, oh, I think you might have got that wrong, or why don't you mention that? I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, but now I'm out loud and audible, and if I want to steer the conversation, I can and I will, because I'm the interviewer, you are the interviewee. And
it's like breaking the fourth wall. It's exciting.
It's weird. Feels unsettling. As much as I've been hosting many, many shows over the years, it feels weird to flip it like this. But yeah, we're going to interview you about the last 6 years of broadcasting.
I can't believe it. It's such a long time.
I know. And so we're both old, so we were already old when we started, but nonetheless, it still feels like a long time, as much as time goes quickly. Do you remember sort of how you first got involved, your first reaction to break the fourth wall a bit more, when I knew that we were going to have a weekly show? I just did a Facebook post, knowing that I knew a lot of creative people locally, and they knew even more people, and that by a process of kind of connect, 7 degrees of Kevin Baconness, I'd not get Kevin Bacon as a host. That was unlikely and unwanted, but I'd find good people. So I did that Facebook post. Do you remember your reaction to that?
Yes, I absolutely do. I've got a very strong Right Radio origin story on this. So I've had some slightly difficult things happen, like nothing tragic, but, quite a lot of stress in my life. And as you said, I was aware that I was getting more old, and I was thinking, oh, where's my life going and what would I like to do? And my children had got a little bit older, so I was kind of out of that really intense kind of little child space where you just can't really think about anything else. And I was thinking, oh, maybe there's other things that I could do. And I had been to an event with some people, and I just remember kind of seeing some people at this artistic event just really feeling like a lot of regret about things that they hadn't done, and just really feeling kind of like an artistic frustration, like, you know, artistic things just wasn't something that they were allowed to do, or that like somebody had to give them permission to do those artistic things. And I just thought, I am not going to do that. I'm going to take some risks. And when I saw your Facebook post, we'd known each other before, but we hadn't sort of been reconnected that long. And I went, wow, that seems like a really wild thing to do. I'll respond to it. And I thought, oh, well, maybe I can do a bit of research, or I can do some filing or something like that, you know, some really kind of minor part of the creative process. And then you said to me, would you like to host one of the shows? I was like, wow, I had not expected that. And I just went, yeah, take the risk. And I did it. And that just seemed like such a wild thing to do.
And it probably wasn't very long. It was a matter of weeks before we were in that studio for that first show. And we were in with Chad. And Chad, yes, who I knew as occasional chair, I think, of the Student Comedy Society. So when I knew a lot of comedy people, and I expected a lot of response on that score, which I got. And so I was really surprised when Chad went, oh, I'm up for it. And I was like, what would you like? Yeah, dot, dot, dot. I know what you're going to be interested in. And he was like, oh, I'd really love to do literature. I don't think I fully realised. I knew he was doing English, but, you know, his passion for literature, really shone through. And so it was the two of you on that first show. Do you remember kind of that first show who you interviewed and how it felt? Because it was our very first show, full stop.
Yeah, it was. So I do remember it really well. I just, you know, you were going to go, oh, okay, here's somebody that you've never met before. You know, our society is so stratified that I hadn't really spoken to anybody Chad's age, kind of postgraduate-y type age. I hadn't really had any sort of connection. And just building up towards the show, I was just feeling really nervous. I was just going, God, imagine saying something awful on the radio and it being awful. But I got so nervous building up to it that when I actually got there, like, it just kind of went, and you went, right, go into that studio and it's going live in like 10 minutes. And I found, now, I didn't know this at the time, but like that kind of adrenaline surge actually made me think really clearly, because it transpires I've got ADHD. So I was actually really quite kind of confident. I just thought, if you're going to do it, just do it. And I just felt kind of confident doing it. And Chad was such a kind of lovely guy. And there was just like such a love, you know, I felt like there was quite a good rapport between us. And I just thought, just do it. Just do it. And like, just the sense of achievement was just huge, to be honest.
Yeah, it was a lovely chemistry, and it's really interesting because, you know, slightly different generations, maybe that's a bit of it, maybe you were the slightly more motherly one, and but in a way you've both got that personality that's just really encouraging of other people. And certainly that was a reputation Chad had in the Comedy Society. He was very good at being supportive and encouraging and making you feel like you could, you know, because he was doing people wanted to do stand-up, very, very scary. And he was good at encouraging people. And you know, equally you were just very interested. And I think right from day one, and in a way that's never changed, you know, you've always been able to bring that, oh, isn't that interesting, attitude to just all manner of interviewees, whether you know a bit about their subject or not.
Yeah, I have found, and that's what's really surprised me about the show, is that pretty much every single interview, I'm just going, wow, that's so interesting. And I've just felt so privileged that people have kind of let me into that little bit of their lives and they've told me about it. And I just think, wow, that's just so much richness. And I've just learned so much from each person about kind of different aspects. The enthusiasm is incredibly genuine.
Yeah, yeah. And I wonder as well how much it's changed from being in that space where maybe you were around people that felt locked out of creativity, like it's not something they're allowed to do. Did you find from these 6 years of meeting people who were doing incredibly creative, exciting, interesting, unexpected projects, how normal they all are?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. I thought, you know, these people are just like, you know, just like me, and really anybody could do something like this if they wanted to. You know, they just kind of have to find where their interest is. Like, no matter how obscure that interest is, whether they're interested in Victorian plummet and they want to write about that, or, you know, whether they've got a serious thriller or a romance, you know, just, you know, it's about taking the risk, not being afraid if it fails, not being afraid if it's bad. You know, I remember a guy who'd written a novel, and he said, I looked at the first novel and I'd written it all and I realised, oh, actually, it's not very good. And he just started another one. And but he wasn't kind of disheartened by it. And I was like, wow, that is, you know, such a revelation. And everybody's journey is just so different into writing. And you have permission to try. And I just really, I suppose, as my children would say, because I am a massive boomer, you know, sorry, I won't say that, because my parents think that I'm quite middle-aged, you know, I maybe had an older sense of, you know, who's allowed to do cultural things, that, you know, somebody had to say, oh, you're very good at this, or you had to have some sort of qualification, and that you couldn't just join in as a kind of a creative act, that you kind of jump into the stream of creativity, and the important thing is being in the river. It's not necessarily what comes out, it's just that you're in there and you're discovering, and that's the important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. The last few days, for no very good reason, I've been watching some sort of arena type documentaries. One of them was an arena, but like different clips of people talking about writers or other film directors from things in the 80s, and it felt like an alien world, and it felt like shocking, like being punched or hit by something, how silly the interviewees tended to sound when they talked about this film director, right, whichever it was. They would all be like, you know, I think he is probably one of the most important people that's ever lived in this area. Yeah, I think his writing, it shows an oeuvre that is, and they all had to kind of reach for a superlative. They couldn't just talk about the thing as a thing that was interesting just because it was interesting. They had to say why it was so important, why it was so world breaking. And it really felt like, looking back, I was like, yeah, that was such a thing in the 80s that you could, it wasn't, why would we be talking about this person on television unless they were in some way world changing? And just because, well, it's quite interesting, it's fine for things to just be quite interesting, like Philip K. Dick. Maybe he's a world changing writer, maybe he's just a good writer, maybe he's a terrible writer that had some interesting ideas, but you don't have to, he was one of the people, be, you know, so this is everything, this man is the most important thing ever, it's just a writer, you know,
yeah, just a and writer. In the past it was a kind of, you know, elitism, it was a kind of hierarchical thing, it was like, oh, you know, you'll write something and everybody will recognize your amazing genius. And, you know, across the show, you know, that's been a kind of a theme, because we've had people who've, like, they really wanted to write something and kind of get some recognition with it. And then we've had people who are just like writing just to bring something into existence. And, you know, really moving to have people. And what really came across to me is just how kind of brutal and random the business is, because we've just had some amazing writers. And I suppose now, you know, if your work gets recognized, like, you might have somebody who is the most towering, outstanding, superlative genius, and like their work would never get published. That could so easily happen.
Yeah.
And not because just how people deal with that and come to terms with that, that might happen, and that it's, you know, and then it's like, well, how can people assess their work? Do they go, oh, well, it hasn't got published, so it's not very good, or do they keep plugging? So we've had writers who have written something and plugged it and plugged it and plugged it, and it's taken them years and years and years to get it published, but in the end they've got it published. And then we've had people who've written something and gone, look, this is going nowhere, I'm going to try something else. And, you know, each of those approaches is just so interesting every time. But if you think about somebody like Emily Dickinson, Stevie Smith, you know, those people, they were nerds just writing stuff in their room. And you think, you know, there must be so many of those people out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably now, I don't know, maybe even fewer of them get attention. I don't know. I mean, that'd be the interesting thing to know.
I think a lot more people are writing now. I mean, the access to the resources to write, not just pencil and paper or computers or whatever, but time as well.
Yeah.
Know, I think people, maybe that's changing. I hope it's not too much, but like, definitely, say, Victorian working classes, pretty time poor, I think, and pretty intense living, and yeah, not given the resources to do so much writing. But yeah, 21st century, we've got a lot more resources. And interesting, on that very first show, one of the interviewees was talking about NaNoWriMo, National Novel yes. Writing Month, this November. And it's really interesting seeing a younger generation where you've got fan fiction is a really big thing. And when I say younger generation, you know, people coming up to their 40s will have grown up doing fan fiction, reading and producing it. And I think that is very much something where people are happy for it to be, not necessarily, even rubbish, because then it can be funny rubbish, but like good enough. Just, I am interested in these characters. Tell me another story about them. It might not be as good as whatever was written by the original authors, but like, I just want to hear more from that universe, those characters. And I'd like to hear your take on them, complete stranger on the internet. Real, genuine passion projects. And it, yeah, it feels like something you would do, like gaming or, you know, any other hobby out there. You could sit down and just write something to write something. Not because you want to be famous. Yeah, or... right.
And the way it's opened up where, you know, over the shows, we've talked about people who are involved in role playing, which, like, to me, in my younger days, was just so far away, divided from something that was artistic and creative. And like now, I'm like, wow, this is a huge world of creativity. Yeah, which is just you know, and the mix up. In fact, at the weekend, I was at Cabaret Boom Boom, and one of the performers had been involved with one of the projects that Dan Sumption has been involved in, and kind of was talking about that. And I'm like, wow, you know, what a crossover. Who would have expected that?
Yeah. And I suppose that's another thing. When I've, because we're coming to the end of a run, a 6-year run, maybe it's the end, maybe it's not. But as I was contemplating, maybe I don't have the time to do this anymore, but any time I might have contemplated that before, which I haven't really, I'd be thinking, you know, what else can I do? What was the point of doing this? Is this enough? And I think when I've been reflecting on it, I've been reflecting on how doing Right Radio has changed my life and connections that it's made, things that I've done outside of the radio show that I wouldn't have done otherwise, people that I now know. And so those connections you talk about, have you seen that develop in your own life over the last
oh yeah
years?
So much, yeah, like the people that I've met, and you know, even sometimes if that might be just like a connection on Facebook, even I haven't met that person in real life, but I've chatted to them on Facebook. Vicky Hive, the one of the yeah. amazing Sheffield awesome. poets. Just like an honor to meet them. I would never, you know, as a sort of just as a, you know, a matron, or you know, if I've worked in a like an office, I'd never have met like amazing people like that. Stan Skinny, who I've seen perform, and I'm just like, oh, you know, these are people who I've like, you know, have a little chat about their art, and when I go out, I'm like, oh yeah, I can critique the comedy that I'm seeing in a confident way, and you know, say, oh, I wonder why it's connecting with the audience or it isn't. And yeah, it's just like a whole new way of looking at the world, really.
Yeah. Do you feel sort of more like a participant in the cultural
yeah,
life of Sheffield?
I absolutely do feel like a participant now, and I feel like. I can really look and just go, you know, when I first started thinking about writing, I thought, okay, well, I can do some writing, I can join a writing course, that's the way that you do it. I tried doing that, and although it was a perfectly nice writing course, I just really just didn't work for me, and it just really made me feel, oh, you know, is this good? Like, why would I be here if this wasn't any good? And like, I'm looking at the other people in the class when we're reading stuff out, and I'm going, oh, do they think that's good? Is that okay? Like, trying to second guess their kind of view. And I just would never do that now. And just like, I can say that being an interviewer for 6 years is the best writing course you could ever do, because like, you learn about how people get things published. You learn about people's creative process. And, you know, you learn about critiquing things and just like the massive, massive importance of editing and just sort of simplifying and pure. And it's like, and it really made me think, you know, it isn't actually about writing, because very, very, very large numbers of people are really good at like writing something descriptive, you know, particularly if you're quite a sensory observer. You know, and you can sort of have a really intense response to, you know, something that you've seen in, you know, a scene or something. So many people can do that and just kind of write it and write your feelings about it. But the massive, massive, massive skill is then to edit that into a kind of more pure and transcendent form. So it just hasn't got all the kind of flannel in it, just like the sort of fat and filler in it, and just to simplify it. And then the other thing is to write something that other people are going to connect with, or that's going to make sense to another person. And it isn't just like telling somebody about that time that you got really drunk, or that you had a dream about something, and it's like something that's going to be meaningful to another person, and that those are the real skills.
That kind of
came across to me from talking to our many gifted, amazing writers.
And I think one of the things that came across to me that I'm sort of already aware of is how much of writing is graft.
Yes,
you know, so it is an amazing process. It is taking the knocks. It is just making yourself sit down and do it when you don't want to do it. And I was already aware of that because I've been doing writing sort of ish for a living every so often. And I would call it like discipline. You know, you've got to discipline to make yourself sit down. And actually, from those interviews, I've changed that perspective. It's motivation. There are people that are not disciplined about their writing, but they put in the work because they care, because they love it, because it's so important to them to get a story out. It's motivation. And I think that's the really beautiful thing I think we've seen with a lot of the writers is...
Yeah, it's the passion. The passion.
Yeah, and we get to, on the show, we get to bring that out of them. And often writing's a very private process. Obviously, it's you and the keyboard or whatever. Most of the time for most people and it's such a weird you are weirdly obsessed about this one idea that's just sort of stuck inside your head until you can get it out. And if you try and explain it to somebody, sometimes you just sound literally insane. And so getting people to come on the show and talk to them seriously and interestedly, we're interested in hearing about this story that they're often keeping private from people because they're a little bit embarrassed. Like, because if they start about it, people will be like, oh, okay, that sounds interesting. But we're like, oh, that sounds interesting. And it's so great seeing that shiny-eyed look.
Yeah, I love that. That's my most favourite thing. You just think, oh, I've really made that person's day in being interested in their thing.
Yeah, and they get to talk about it with real depth and passion where they wouldn't normally.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
That's what we want. That's a good interview. I'm there as a producer being like, oh, this is edibly good. Oh,
get that. And we're going, oh, this is gold afterwards. Where, you know, either you get an amazing origin story or you just get like the massive passion of, you know, just how much people love and enjoy the worlds that they've built.
Yeah, yeah.
I can tell you my favourite origin story. Yes. One of the guys who was a comedian and a writer, and he said I think he had a job as a caretaker in a school, and he was just writing secretly. And he didn't tell anyone, and he didn't tell his wife, and it was just like completely secret. And he told us the story of how he'd moved from like hiding everything that he had written to suddenly going, right, I'm going for it, and just going out on stage and doing stand-up and then just never looking back. And I'm like, oh, that is maximum life affirming.
Yeah, yeah.
He just found that confidence just to go off and do it.
You can see a Hollywood movie made out of that, can't you?
I could, yeah, absolutely. I could, and like that could be anybody really, and you know, no matter what people's creative interest might be, you know, be it the person in Crooks who is like crocheting amazing mice and then putting them on the top of post boxes, you know, they are making the world a better place, you know, or whatever kind of obscure craft or artistic interest people have.
Yeah, and I think that's the sort of first basis of what Right Radio was about, was providing that kind of a platform for you to share your creativity as a writer, but there to be a purpose for you to do your writing, because often, like we say, people are hiding it away because who is this for?
Yeah.
And like, it was nice to be able to say it's for us,
it
and
is.
Then we'll show it, share it with the world, and I don't know how much feedback we'll get you. We very rarely get any sort of feedback, but we're still a flat platform. People are still hearing it. People are still enjoying the show.
Yeah, that's right. It's like, it's there. It's happened. People can tell their family that they've been on it and that we were interested, which we were. And that just felt like the purpose. And when I first started it, I thought, why am I doing this? I thought, are people going to listen? Do I want people to listen? Do I not want people to listen? And then I found out that there's actually like a network of art radios like all over the country. It's like Resonance FM. I heard Stuart Lee and his friends like talking about it. And like, even though those guys had like been on telly, like they were still going into Resonance FM and doing their thing there. And I think, well, if you know, if people who have been on telly can do that, I can do that. And you know, just give people that platform to say and to have a voice, and like, what could be better than that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so we are winding up the interview, winding up the show. You've learned a lot, you've grown a lot.
I have, and I would like to thank you for the opportunity for letting me do it.
And what do you think is next? So if that was a big leap 6 years ago, you thought, well, that'd be a wild and crazy thing to do. If you could, if you were allowed, and you are allowed, what crazy wild leap would you like to take next?
Well, so I've done Right Radio, and now I am getting together with some friends to try and create a middle-aged lady performance arts comedy group.
That's everything I could have hoped for from this project.
Yeah, that was your dream. That was your dream for me, and that's happened. And like, we're talking about different characters that we can do, and you know, it might take a bit of time, but that's like, we are in that space. We're thinking, right, what can we do? You know, and so that, and also I thought, because when I first started, I thought, oh, maybe I want to write poetry. Well, I don't want to write poetry, it transpires. I really like comedy writing, and also kind of journalism type writing. So I'm hoping to write some special needs posts. I just think, look, just write them and then find a place for them to go, because that is the Right Radio message.
Exactly. Yeah. Do the art first and then work out what you want to do with it. But passion first, always passion first.
That's right. And then you can come to see whatever we and my friends have done, and you can be proud of us.
I literally cannot wait. Jane Armstrong, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
That was an interview with me, Jane, talking to my producer. I really enjoyed doing that interview. It was a real honour, and it was brilliant. My turn to be in the hot seat finally after 6 years of talking to you. And now we've got our last item of the show. We've got Where We're Coming From and Where We're Going To by Jim Jeps, read by Sam Birch. Yeah.
You can't hear me from where you're sitting.
No, you can't. That noise you hear is simply a cascade of atoms. Ripples that conspire to give the illusion of sound. It's a trick. A surge of molecules electronically captured, stored as a series of ons and offs, then beamed across the world as radio waves. This storm of vibrations is translated by an army of boxes on kitchen tables that gently nudge the air around them, causing domino after domino to fall, just so, battering your ears in a pre-designated pattern where this rain of physical objects are decoded in your cranium into something that can't possibly be true. It's an executive toy of chain reaction. A timpani in your eardrum at one end and my infernal plotting at the other. I'm not even in the room with you. Although I dearly wish I was. Unbelievably, I'm not even speaking now. Despite the fact that it seems that way to both of us. This recording happened some time ago, and now we rehash this moment from an unidentified hour in an anonymous location, and yet you say you hear me speaking. Go off it. Considering the complexity of the universe and the profound manipulation of physics required, it's a marvel we can communicate at all. A true wonder. Literally as ancient as time and more futuristic than any of the sci-fi spectaculars so tied to ships and strictly delineated exoticism that they may as well be Hornblower novels. Never attempting to stretch the periphery of our universe, such as the deep conservatism of the genre. I digress. You may not be hearing me, but that's no reason why we can't talk. Talk about how we got here, about where we're going, about the precarious edges that we live our lives upon. Sometimes balancing, sometimes unbalanced. But before we get there, let's discuss this letter. I don't doubt that it exists. I'm not unhinged, but I do suspect the ink. Scattered into semi-rectangular shapes, these markings are designed to draw us into untruths. At least, they're untruths if we choose not to believe them. Take this patch of markings here. Five simple shapes. An E, a V, an I, a C. Oh, the unimaginative creep who wrote this filth. And to top it off, a T. Of all things, what am I to make of it, if anything? What might an order of possession even mean? Are my possessions in an order? What order? Alphabetical? Numerical? An order of preference or price? What a ludicrous exercise. If people are going to go to the effort of writing me a letter, why not write one which will make me happy? A J. Like at the start of Jaunty. Could have raised a smile. That would have been something. What about X? As an X-ray. No? I'd have seen through that. Okay, I'm sorry. But when you consider that human beings of one kind or another have been around for what? 2.3 million years? How old can a joke actually be? Particularly one about X-ray. I doubt the early hominids got beyond slapstick and fart gags, but that's speculation, I suppose. Perhaps Homo habilis had a sophisticated and nuanced sense of the absurd as she battered stones together to make the first flint tools. Was that first axe head a delicious joke that simply got out of hand? Let's get back to this so-called letter, and its frankly pathetic attempt to make me believe I am to be dislodged from my lodgings. Who's to define what antisocial behaviour really is? It's not a thing. It's an interpretation, isn't it? I'm part of the social, aren't I? How could anything actually be antisocial if I do it? It doesn't make sense. It's not as if I owe them money. After all, how can one person owe another an abstract concept? It's maddening. If we could all just agree on these simple, indisputable truths, then everyone would be happier. At least I would. Let's forget about this silly eviction nonsense. It's all so petty. There are billions of stars in the galaxy, and we sit on a speck of dirt circling just one of them. Not even a particularly interesting one. There are plenty of stars hotter, or bigger, or younger, or older. There are twin stars caught in their mutual orbit of blistering fire. Imagine that! I remember she took my head in her hands, tenderly turned my face to the sky. She asked me to pick out a star, any star that I could see. I thought about it for an age, my back resting against her legs. It was a crisp, clean country sky. There were so many to choose from. I scorned the brightest, the clearest, the sharpest, the ones right above, or those seemingly hovering over our home like celestial signposts. At last I picked one, my star. It was faint, and off to the side. But these are tricks of perspective, the rotation of our planet, the distortion of our atmosphere. I pointed. She squinted, paused, and told me, even that one's better than here. Even that one. But I couldn't hear her. I just thought I could. Threw cold hands over my ears and the bewildering distances between us, around us, captured in the hail of atoms that made up her words, rippling through her fingers as if they were real. So how do we get here? I've never understood why people are so obsessed with monkeys. It's not much of a leap, is it? A person being descended from some sort of ape. Come on, they even look like people. Admittedly, the sort of character you bump into down an alley gives you a little heart pump. But turns out to be charming, after all. It's more surprising that that ape and all mammals were descended from some tiny mouse thing. Why is that never remarked upon? Human beings are the progeny of some ridiculous rodent, surely far more astonishing than something that actually looks very like a hairy person. And that's before we consider the fact, the scientific fact, that the amazing mouse grandmother to us all was itself descended from a sponge. Pull your finger out, creationists. If you want to sow seeds of doubt, don't deride the fact that we're the children of apes. Mock the fact that we're related to something akin to a flannel. It won't wash. That's something that would make even the most die-hard devotee of science and scholarship wary, even though it's true. Consanguineous with a squeegee. I should coco. At least that's something I'd imagine they'd say. All of these fundamental transformations took place in a fraction of the history of the clod of muck we call a planet. So when you consider all of that, who are we to say what is or is not antisocial behaviour? Not I. When Grandmother Mouse, Jeremiah Sinensis, to give her scientific name, it means Jurassic Mother of China, which is lovely. China is a beautiful place to visit. When Grandmother Mouse was giving birth to this litter that would go on to make every horse, every bear, every woman, every weasel, every kangaroo, little did she know it would all end in this ridiculous eviction notice. She'd be turning in her little grave. She would. God bless. Well, not God. I don't know what God would think. Apart from a general sense of surprise existing in a universe where at best you embody a set of rules, not the programmer but the program itself, where you actually are the commandments that govern gravity, the speed of light, the nature of time, what an easy feeling that would be. If it's possible to have feelings about glands, about hormones, about chemicals sloshing around a corporeal being, mucking it up, making everything untidy. I digress. Again. I'd happily pay the rent if someone could give me a satisfactory explanation of what money is. I mean, actually is. And if I had any. So, you see, we may as well leave it there. Draw a line under it. No harm. We both go happily on our way. Although, of course, that doesn't involve me actually going anywhere, quite the opposite. That's just a metaphor for me not being evicted. When we parted, she left me here. If she came looking, this is where she'd expect me to be. Here, in this spot. If we can even say here when the wet rock We're travelling on it, spinning at 1,070 miles an hour. It's slipping round our star at 18 and a half miles every second. Our solar system is zooming away at a whopping 155 miles a second within our galaxy, which itself has been vomiting along from its very birth at 105 miles a second. So where is here? In a way, we're all being constantly evicted from where we were just a moment ago. Well, it makes me dizzy. I don't know about you. The largest stone, the most sedentary rock formation, no matter what appearances may say, is not stationary, but hurtling faster than Apollo 9, like an unguided missile through space. She left me here, and if I'm no longer here, then I'd be lost. Perhaps I am already. Are we within reach of what was here a moment ago, let alone a year before? Here makes no sense in a universe defined by motion. It doesn't seem credible. You can see my problem. Well, you can't see it. You can't even hear me. Not really. We've established this, surely. We've built a world of illusions around us to help us cope with hard, unknowable physical facts. Illusions that date back to Grandmother Mouse, and possibly before. Who knows what Great Grandmother Sponge would have to say about it all? Very little, I suspect. When that little mouse brain said to itself, "I've seen that seed, I've tasted that seed, that's a good seed, yum," her brain was indulging in a useful trick that served us so well that we're still doing it 160 million years later. We're still keeping up the pretense that we see, hear, touch and taste, when really it's just clashing molecules, well-designed receptors and neurons firing in such complex formations that we had to create thought just to make sense of them. Her old scarf plays me for a fool. It has me delude myself. It's a bitter deception that turns my stomach, at least I think it does. Her fading perfume is the essence of everything that's gone, that died with her. Residing as a tenant of the past, once we had abandoned a moment, does it not leave a residue? Is a life consumed, or is it set in aspic? Never to be changed, never erased. If she's gone, why does her presence hurt me so hard? This is my question to you, eavesdroppers. Does the past exist? Or, like these splashes of ink or the farce we call money, is it only true if we all take it to be so? Mediated by common understanding, a shared codebook of thoughts and behaviour. Does she lie back there, in time, before now, or is her absence final and absolute? Could it be that she's close at hand, if I believe she is? Living in my memory, her presence caught in a trap of firing neurons, hot sparks, conjuring phantasms, or is she... Is her only truth that she is absent? A bleak hole that helps define the edges of the light around it. This paw print in wet sand is transitory evidence that she walked upon the earth. That she loved me. Grandmother Mouse. What do you say? Where is my mother now? Is your daughter lost so far from here as we hurl ourselves forward, always 1,000 miles from where we were an instant before? Does she weep for me? Or are my tears unreciprocated? When they come to lever me from this shell, will I get a better sense of where I'm going than where I've been? Or will I lie on the street, looking at the night sky, searching for a star that points nowhere?